Profit shifting essentially works by moving accounting profits without moving real activity. This hurts twice as much in developing countries as rich countries, simply because the corporate taxes is more important there.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Multinational enterprises in every industry, well, they got one activity in common. They attempt to shift their profits to low tax jurisdictions. And these corporate tax havens, well, they end up reducing tax revenues in developing countries as a result. The numbers are huge, but what can policy or enforcement of policies do to change this situation? And the International Growth Centre has published a policy toolkit into corporate tax havens. And Ludwig Wier of the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs is the author. He joins me now. Ludwig, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much, Tim. I'm very happy to be here.
You're talking to me in a private capacity. What you say to me today is not Danish government policy.
Exactly.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk about one of those big numbers. How much of corporate tax revenue do we think is lost to this type of tax avoidance?
Yeah, so I actually looked at this with my two colleagues, Gabriel Suckman and Thomas Terslow. And in our paper, The Missing Profits of Nations, we estimate that roughly 10% of global corporate tax receipts, they are lost due to this type of behavior. So in 2022, that implies that roughly $1 trillion were shifted to tax havens and that more than $200 billion in global corporate tax receipts were lost.
I imagine these companies aren't too anxious to advertise this fact. How hard is it to make this estimate?
It's very hard. It begins with us having to agree on the object that we are estimating. So I define, alongside the rest of the research community, profit shifting as an intentional and tax-motivated mismatch between where economic activity takes place and where profits are reported. So in this paper, I referred to the missing profits of nations. We use a lot of different indicators to actually measure economic activity. We look at wages paid, capital deployed, R&D expenditures, etc. And the fact of the matter is, whatever indicator you use, you'll end up having this picture where lots and lots of profits are reported in tax havens, but very little economic activity. So when you end up doing this exercise using national accounts, it becomes pretty obvious what is going on. Mm-hmm. You can also do it this a bit more directly, and I've been doing this in South Africa with my colleague Haley Erasmus, where we actually looked at all the transactions being conducted by multinationals. And then you can, in a very direct way, look at, for example, when a South African subsidiary imports sugar from a tax haven, what price do they pay to an affiliated company and what price do they pay to an unaffiliated company? And then you can really, really get not only an idea of the number, but also how this is being done.
Which companies are responsible for this? Is everyone doing it?
Actually not. So in my paper, The Dominant Role of Large Firms in Profit Shifting, I look at this and what we find is that the bulk of multinational companies do no profit shifting. I also think that's why many multinationals get upset when they have to listen to people like you saying that they cheat a lot. But the fact is, the fact is that it's the very largest that do profit shift. Mm-hmm. And because the very largest have all the profits, then there end up being a lot of profit shifting. So for example, in South Africa, we find that 98% of profit shifting is done by the largest 10% of foreign-owned firms.
Yeah, I should walk back the first sentence of my introduction.
No.
Shouldn't I? Some multinational enterprises in some industries have one activity in common. Let me ask you, for the ones that do this, how much resource, how many people do they commit to this activity?
What we can do is we can look at the total number of people employed globally working on transfer pricing. And we just looked at LinkedIn and we found more than 300,000 individuals. And that tells you, first of all, that the current legislation is way too complex, right? That we need to have so many people just working on following the rules is enormous. It, of course, also tells you that there is some creative thinking going on along how to interpret this legislation. And we also looked at then how this compares with the public sector. And we find a bit more than 3,000 individuals working on this in the public sector. So it's really a 1 to 100 ratio, which tells you that it's very hard to enforce this.
Let's spell it out to me. How important is this for developing countries and for development?
It's much more important in developing countries than in rich countries. And that is because the corporate tax constitutes a larger share of the total tax base in the developing countries. Historically, it used to be the easiest tax to collect. Instead of going to millions of small taxpayers, you go to the very large ones and you collect the tax. So this hurts twice as much in developing countries as rich countries when firms avoid or evade, simply because the corporate tax is more important there. Add to this that developing countries are also having a harder time to then enforce the current rules. Well, then you have two issues, right? You have the issue that you rely more on corporate taxation and that you have a harder time actually enforcing the rules.
Well, let's take a break, and in a second, we'll discuss how exactly this process works.
Throughout West Africa, women leaders are driving meaningful change.
You have to think about the way the country looks at its women and how it views its girls.
Hear their stories in the podcast, Women Leading Change, brought to you by the Sahel and West Africa Club at the OECD.
We've neglected our indigenous foods, which were historically very healthy.
I'm your host, Dr. Lena Coney-Hoffman. Tune in and be inspired as we explore the connections between gender and climate change, food systems, conflict, and urban expansion.
Women have risen to protect their children, to protect their families, to protect communities in the face of real terrorism.
So, Ludwig, explain to me, you have all these skilled people in many locations around the world doing profit shifting. What are they doing? How does it work?
Profit shifting essentially works by moving accounting profits without moving real activity. There are many complex ways of describing this, but it all goes back to mispricing transactions. Let me give an example. You have designed a new killer search algorithm. Or a recipe for an amazing donut, or a really beautiful logo, You now have an intellectual property, which is going to be very, very valuable. Now, say that you actually created this recipe or intellectual property in Denmark. In reality now, you'll have all branches of the multinational company paying royalties to Denmark. So Denmark will see a lot of profits. Now, if you as a multinational firm wants to ensure that those profits instead appear in a low-tax country, for example, Ireland, then you need to make sure that the intellectual property is located in Ireland. How can you do that? Well, you can actually just sell it internally. So you can sell the IP that is registered in Denmark to your own branch in Ireland. And if you sell it at a very early stage where it's very unclear what the value is, are these donuts really so tasty as you think? Well, then it's very unclear what the price will be, and then there is room for maneuvering what price you're actually setting. So that's just one example of in your transactions internally in the multinational company, you can make value appear in low-tax countries.
But to be clear, we are talking about something that is legal here. So do the tax authorities that would have got tax revenue from this, and now they are not getting tax revenue from this, do they just have to shrug and say, well, this is how it goes? Or can they challenge this?
So I think it's too simple to say it's legal.
Right.
Like all matters of tax compliance, this is the dull version of 50 Shades of Grey. Mm-hmm. So in all tax legislation, you'll try to interpret the intent of the law. So, for example, in the example I just gave, this behavior is clearly going against the intent of the law. If you are intentionally setting a price of an IP too low, with the intention to avoid taxes, well, this is clear-cut tax evasion. But the question is then, how do you prove this in court? And that is very tricky, right? No one knows their intellectual property better than the multinational company itself. Now, if you're transacting these patents and IP at an early stage, it's near impossible for a tax authority to actually go and make a judgment that goes beyond saying, well, you at least need to price this IP at the cost you paid to make it, for example. That's a common procedure you use, right? But it's just to say we have kind of set the tax authorities up to fail with the system because we are asking them to challenge behavior of a firm that no one but the firm really knows best.
And this is what stops them from going after every firm that is profit shifting in every jurisdiction, because if it was easy to do, that's what they would do, and that would be a profitable activity.
Yeah, exactly. So together with, again, Gabriel Zucman and Thomas Tørsler, we actually got to follow the Danish transfer pricing unit. Mm-hmm. And Denmark is a rich country. We have one of the most bolstered tax authorities in the world compared to our size. In Denmark, there are 40,000 multinationals operating. And of those, less than 1% will see their transfer pricing documentation audited.
Wow.
And of that 1%, only 25% will face a correction. So that's 0.25% of the total transactions actually get corrected. And when we then look at the actual corrections, most of them will get challenged in court and eventually be dropped. So we end up having a situation where 0.1% of the transactions are actually corrected and finalized. And when we then look at those corrections, what we actually see, which I'm sure you're going to be asking me about more, is that the corrections that are actually finalized are not transactions going to tax havens. They are between high-tax countries.
Right.
So just to say, one of the most advanced tax authorities in the world that have a lot of resources, they end up only correcting a very small share of transactions and a tiny share of transactions with tax havens.
So it sounds like the life of a corporate tax inspector. It's not an easy life. It's a thankless task doing this. But say I was doing this job. I'm very glad I'm not. But say I was doing this job and I wanted to investigate a company. Where do I start with this? What information from that company can I access? What can I see?
In most countries, there's going to be an abundance of data that you can access. Uh-huh. So the problem becomes, what do you do with all that information?
Yes. I imagine that it's not presented in a way, a format that would make it easy for me to make a decision.
And just the sheer volume of it. For example, firms, you can tell them that in every country, you can just order a firm to supply their transfer pricing documentation. And then you can also, in most countries, get access to all customs and banking information. So essentially, mm-hmm. in most countries, you'll be able to see the bulk of transactions that a multinational firms do. So now you have billions of data points, what to do with those, right? And that's really what I've been working together with the UN and IMF with, helping low-income countries. How do you process all of this data? And of course, this is where algorithms, now called AI, comes into the picture, right? Because you really need computers going through this data because no human can.
Tell me a little bit more about this, because as you say, you managed to follow the Danish tax authorities in their work and they are very well resourced. By comparison, a low middle income country, what sort of resources do they have? Well, how many highly skilled people do they have who are able to do this work?
First of all, I don't think there's any country in the world that essentially have enough resources yes. going through it, because it's really just an impossible task. But as you're saying, in developing countries, it's particularly grim. And when you go to low-income countries, you have as little as one transfer pricing specialist working on this, right? Mm-hmm. And that is really something that I have put forward in this paper you referred as an area of future research. How do you even conceptually approach this task when you're so understaffed? And again, you'll be in a situation where you have plenty of data. That's not the problem. How you process it and how you actually make this into actual corrections and how you follow up on those corrections in court, that's going to be the entire challenge.
Yes, I imagine you need quite a lot of resources as well, because there's a huge incentive for these organizations to drag out this process, isn't there? Challenge everything in court.
Exactly. With the one nuance being that we see in this paper I did with Gabriel and Thomas that multinationals, they won't object if you're doing a correction with a higher tax country, right?
Oh, yeah.
So say you're a multinational, you've done an import from France to Sweden. If that transaction is corrected, you can end up paying lower taxes globally. Now, as a multinational, you're not going to object to this. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the data. But if you have a correction with Ireland, we see without question that the multinational will take it into court. So that's why when we look at the final results, we actually have the bulk of corrections being done between high tax countries, not between low tax countries and high tax countries.
It sounds like auditing and enforcement of these audits is a very, very difficult job. So maybe we should look in the other direction and look at the tax havens instead. What efforts have been put into cracking down on those?
There's been many efforts. And in my paper with Gabriel Sukman called Global Profit Shifting, we look at the time series. And what we see is that essentially all of these efforts failed, except the very most recent one, which was the corporate minimum tax.
Uh-huh.
And that was agreed upon in the OECD. More than 130 countries went together and designed this genius system where you make sure that the multinational will pay no less than 15% in corporate taxes, no matter what country you look at. And the genius way this was designed is that it doesn't matter if the tax haven is in the agreement, because it's the headquarter that will collect the residual, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really set up in a way that you level the playing field no matter whether the tax havens are in the agreement or not. And what we saw as a result was exactly that the tax havens have now started raising their effective tax rates to make sure that they get to collect the corporate taxes instead of just having the corporate headquarter do it.
But if we have this agreement in place, and as you say, it sounds well designed, will it solve the problem?
It will solve the problem depending on two things. First is that to completely solve the problem, you need to raise the minimum tax, right? So right now, you still have an incentive. 15% corporate tax rate is still below most advanced economies' tax rate. So there's still an incentive, but you've curbed a lot of it. And we can see that in the data, that the increase in profit shifting has stopped. So in that sense, it's already working. There'll be two issues. One is, as I said, to completely stop it, you need an effective tax rate more at the level of 20 or 25%.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have the system, so you can do that. The other thing is, in the design, there was the idea that you would have what was called the under-tax payments rule, which is a complicated way of saying that when the headquarter is not part of the agreement, you would have the subsidiary collect the minimum tax.
Right.
And that's going to be important in the long run, because otherwise firms can organize themselves around this new minimum tax. It was part of the agreement, but now, as I'm sure you've noticed, Tim, there's international turmoil about international taxes. So this safety mechanism is in danger now, and it's part of some very heated debates on how to actually tax other countries, right? So I would say it's working right now, but I could fear in the future whether this will keep working if these safety mechanisms are not implemented.
So as you said, Ludwig, there is now some international cooperation, which I think many people thought that they would never see in their lifetimes. There is potential to achieve a lot, but will this necessarily work in the interests of developing countries?
Just to reiterate, as you said, I think this was a massive multilateral success.
Mm-hmm.
It's already working. And if you make the tweaks to it that I discussed, well, then the problem goes away and it forces a level playing field. You stop the race to the bottom. And in that sense, you have to look at the counterfactual. The counterfactual was that the corporate tax would die, simply vanish to exist because countries were competing to set lower corporate tax rates. You've stopped that. Everybody wins. But I think your questions go to something that is a sensitive topic and is being discussed a lot in the UN, which is that rich countries tend to benefit more from this, right?
Yes.
And that's just because the way it is right now, our corporate tax system, when you look aside from intentional tax avoidance, you still end up reporting most of your profits in the headquarter country. That's where the R&D is happening. That's where you create the patents, and that's where the profits are reported. And this is not something that there is universal agreement upon being the right distribution of profits. And it ends up being that lower income countries get a lower share. And as I said, this is a question of heated debates, and there's for sure not a solution in this system against that. But this minimum tax solves the problem of tax motivated profit shifting.
Is there anything that developing countries can do unilaterally through policy to improve their enforcement, to collect more tax under this new evolving regime?
The beauty of the minimum tax is that's going to work no matter what you do as a developing country. But unilaterally, what you of course need to do as any country is to try to enforce this complicated set of tax rules. I think this is really an area of future research. How to think of a transfer pricing unit of potentially as little as one person working in a low-income country, how they can meaningfully enforce the tax system. What I've been working with many low-income countries with through the IMF is to use AI as a solution, right? Uh-huh. AI can help you do lots of analyses. There still needs to be a human that follow these corrections through the door.
The human in the loop, as they
exactly.
call it.
Exactly, and just someone needs to appear in court eventually, et cetera, right? So it's not going to be the full solution, but I think there's a lot that can be gained here. And I'll just mention my IMF mentor, Stuart Hamilton, who used to work at the Australian Tax Office. He really has some interesting thinking on this, and he has also written a couple of public IMF reports that I'll encourage people to read.
It does sound like it's encouraging to be able to use technology for this. It stops individuals sitting in an office being overwhelmed by boxes and boxes of documentation or megabytes and megabytes of data. But as you've already mentioned, we are in an environment now where there is much less international cooperation than there was before. There is also evidence that multinational organizations in some jurisdictions have been quite successful at regulatory capture, lessening government's appetite to be able to make improvements like this. Ludwig, how much is really going to change?
I think it's important to just again note that the corporate minimum tax now implemented by the entire EU, for example, and the EU countries, they have headquarters of most multinationals, that minimum tax, that is a real change,
yeah.
And it has put an end to the increase in profit shifting. And I think it's going to be really hard to go back from this. So even though the international cooperation is probably looking into some rough years, then I think it's going to be really hard to completely go back from this situation where you have implemented a system that works. Even if we did go back, I think there's going to be a scenario in the future where we reinstate it, because it has been really hard to figure out a solution to this problem. Now, a solution was figured out and implemented. That's a unique thing. And I also think it's something that you need to look at when you do climate policies and climate cooperation. I would definitely look to this agreement also, because I think it has the right mechanisms. We're looking into some rough years, but I think that once you have demonstrated a good thing, it's going to be hard to go back.
The challenge is still there, but we cannot underestimate the scale of the change that has already been made. Ludwig, thank you very much for talking about it today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Tim.
The IGC's policy toolkit, written by Ludwig, is called Corporate Tax Havens and Their Impact on Development. You can find it by going to the website, which is theigc.org. And you will also see the references to that, links to the papers that we've been talking about, many others as well. And there is some fascinating research already into this. And it looks like there are options for a lot more research as well. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we have articles about the topics we feature. And remember, if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and give us a review.